The clerk would call the next case, please.
The court will now call Aaron Dowdy versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Richard Glanton will argue for the appellant. Ms. Andrea Simmons will argue for the state.
Mr. Glanton.
May it please the court, good afternoon. This appeal involves or has raised two issues. The first issue dealing with a blank verdict form on the question of guilt, and the second issue involves legal sufficiency. Because of the relative greater complexity of the first issue, I'm going to primarily discuss that with you this afternoon. There are several questions. Before I go much further, I did, when I was looking at this last night and actually this morning, I prepared a letter brief that talks a little bit more about the legislative history of Article 3701. I intend to file that, if the court grants me leave now, later today when I return to my office. I provided a copy of that letter brief to opposing counsel, Ms. Simmons, and so that the court knows what to look forward to later today. If you do grant me leave, I'd like to present that to you now. I think it probably clarifies a little bit what we're talking about.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, sir.
And for the record, may I have leave to electronically file that later today?
Is there any objection?
No objection from the state.
Anyone have any? Okay, yes.
Okay, thank you. I'll do so. As discussed in the opening brief of the appellant, prior to 1879, there was common law that permitted jury verdicts on guilt in criminal cases. It relieved or did not impose any requirement that the verdict be in writing or that it be signed by the foreman. There is a civil case that was addressed by a court of last resort in Texas that actually expressly held that very early, back in the 1750s, I believe. In 1879, or actually in 1876, as explained in this letter brief, the Texas legislature passed a statute directing the governor to appoint commissioners to revise and amend, if necessary or if it was appropriate, the Code of Criminal Procedure as well as the Texas Penal Code and the civil statutes. In the report that was adopted, among those five commissioners was a gentleman named Samuel Wilson with two L's, and for purposes of this argument, he later, after participating as a commissioner, did publish the revised code dealing with the Code of Criminal Procedure and the Penal Code, and included a digest where he talks about the revisions that were proposed by the commissioners and adopted by the legislature in 1879. One of those provisions is what is now 3701, which directs that jury verdicts be in writing. And there is a second provision, which I believe was that was 705, Article 705 in the Code 1879. There is a second revision done by the commissioners in 1879 that I believe was Article 706, and that actually expressly stated that the foreman of a jury would be required to sign a verdict. So it had to be in writing, had to be signed. Our current code provisions, we still have 3701 that says it shall be in writing. Of course, after the 1879 code was enacted, you then began to have criminal appellate decisions acknowledging that those earlier decisions have been abrogated legislatively and that it's required that the jury verdict be on guilt be in writing and that it be signed by the foreman. In this case, we don't have a verdict. We have a blank verdict form. And that's in the appendix, appellant's appendix 1 in the opening brief at page 8, I believe, but it's clerk's record 53. And that's the final page with the jury instructions with the verdict page on the last page. In this case, what happened was, is when the jury told the bailiff they had a verdict, They were brought back into the courtroom. The judge asked them if they had a verdict. The foreman stood up and said yes. They passed it to the judge. He looked at it, passed it back to the jury, and then said, read your verdict. And the foreman verbally said, we find the defendant guilty. But there was nothing in writing done, as shown by the record. There's no signature by a jury foreman, although I don't think you really have to get to that question. There's just nothing. There is no verdict because there's nothing in writing.
Does it matter that the jury was polled in this case?
No. And the reason why is because, you know, there's two questions. Number one, there's a question raised by opposing counsel about whether it was waived. On the question of waiver, I don't think that would apply because the requirement of a verdict being in writing is not only a systemic error if it's not done, it's also, and of course, a trial judge has an independent duty to ensure that a verdict is formal or complies with statutory law, including the writing requirement. And under 3710, Article 3710, he has an independent duty to return the jury to repair or correct or satisfy the statutory requirements before he can accept it as a verdict, and then, of course, after that, impose a judgment or render a verdict based upon the jury verdict. Because it's a systemic requirement, and we say a jurisdictional requirement, it cannot be waived.
Do you have a case that says it's a systemic requirement or jurisdictional requirement?
I've cited cases that, Court of Criminal Appeals cases, that say you cannot render a judgment without a verdict.
Okay, but the fact that it's not signed...
Okay, it's not in writing.
Okay, it's not signed, not in writing, nothing in writing. I get it.
Okay.
But do you have any case that says that the fact that it's not in writing is systemic and therefore you don't have to raise it?
Waived for failure to object, I suppose.
Right.
There may be some cases where the Court of Criminal Appeals addressed it without there being an objection. The case law is not real clear on that. And then, of course, additionally, our position would be is because in common practical trial procedures, a defense counsel would not examine, but would say, I don't believe the judge who's reviewed it first and accepted it, to determine whether or not it was signed or complied with the statutory requirements or not. And I would hope that any kind of objection requirement or preservation requirement would not be interpreted to require, going forward, every criminal lawyer, defense lawyer, to disbelieve what a jury foreman has read because he hasn't read it, and say, well, wait a minute, Judge, I want to not only poll them, but I want to see what he just read to ensure that he signed it, or to ensure that there's some indication. There's not even an indication whether it's guilty or not guilty in this case.
Yeah, it's so easy to see both sides of this argument. I'll be honest with you. It's really easy to see both sides. I'm at a loss as to how this happened, how a judge could take a verdict form that's totally blank and not say, you need to go back in the jury room and make this right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm at a loss to see how that didn't happen, how it was given back to the foreman to read when nothing was signed. I'm at a loss to see how that happened. But then once they're polled, you're asking us to elevate technical, the rule requirement over the fact that six jurors said that's our unanimous verdict.
Okay,
guilty.
Yeah, and that gets to Justice Pittman's question. I think that has to do with the question of whether harmless error applies or not to this type of error. I realize the question of preservation and error sometimes overlap with the question of whether an error is harmless or not. With regard to the harmless question, is our position is that there's a number of statutes, and the lines are not always clear to what the legislature has delegated in the government code to allow a rule of harmless error to apply to one error or another. In this case, you have a statutory requirement that's not that dissimilar to requiring, let's say, for example, if a jury had returned a verdict with seven people in a felony case, or with four people or three people in a misdemeanor case, you would not, in my opinion, be allowed to assess or give determine how much weight in the record there is to support a finding of guilt, because that is a statutory requirement that's required for a valid verdict to be returned. You might say, well, his substantial rights are not being adversely affected because look at all this evidence of guilt. You might even have the three members of the jury or four members of the jury be polled to say that's our unanimous verdict. But it would not be permissible for a rule adopted judicially under the government code, I believe it's section 22 something, that delegates the rulemaking authority to the judiciary. It would not be appropriate for the judiciary to adopt and apply a harmless error rule where the legislature's express directions by statute, such as in this case, it shall be in writing, and if it's not in writing or if there's any defect, the trial judge must return the jury to fix the problem, and that doesn't happen. And of course, as I've said, I did not notice this, quite frankly, it's not shown by the record. I didn't notice this error until after I got the clerk's record, after I'd filed notice of appeal, long after the jury had been discharged.
Mr. Gladden, I want to compliment you on your briefing. I really enjoyed reading it and doing some follow-up research. I think you've done a tremendous job. Like Judge Gabriel, this case does create some issues for me. And I think you've touched on kind of a problem that I can see when we go back and try to decide what we're going to do. Is, as you know, in the Court of Criminal Appeals is very strict when it comes to preservation of error.
Sure.
And they're also very strict when it comes to harmful versus harmless error. And obviously we're bound by all the precedent. You know,
sure.
you have that long line of case law, but you also have time and time again the court saying verdicts should be liberally construed. Appellate courts should do everything they can to make sure that the jury's verdict's ascertained, protect the jury verdict, et cetera, et cetera.
Could I respond?
Yes, sir. Help me out of the quandary.
The difference I see, and of course, the original construction of liberally construing verdicts arose actually in civil cases, and they did not involve cases like this where there is no verdict.
It's not signed. The statute says it has to be. You never even get there.
And we have a distinction between verdicts and informal verdicts, and Article 3701 being a verdict, and Article 3710 being an informal verdict. And with regard to preservation of error, I cite several cases where the Court of Criminal Appeals has addressed informal verdicts. Okay? And in this case, you're not even getting to a point of trying to liberally construe a informal verdict. There's just no verdict at all, formal, informal, or otherwise.
Tell me where the word informal came from in this. I thought that was odd.
I cite to the provisions back in the original code of 1856, and actually it may have been after that, but once they adopted the written verdict format, requiring a verdict be in writing, then they had a provision contemporaneously, and it might have been the commissioners in 1879, that said what happens if a verdict is returned that does not comply with statutory law, and it directs the judge, if it can be construed as an acquittal, the judge can accept it, but he cannot enter a judgment of guilty under 3710, even if he interprets it to be a verdict of guilty, if it's informal and does not comply with
it. Is there another type of informal verdict other than one that's where the verdict form's not signed?
There could be. It could be. There is a case where somebody who wasn't on the jury signed it. Okay? That might be construed as an informal verdict. But in this case, you don't have anybody signing it. And it doesn't indicate which, and of course, when you get into the harmless thing, you say, well, gosh, sure, the jury verbally was polled and verbally said this or that, but I just don't think you can get to that because the trial judge had an independent duty. And, of course, a lot of the preservation of error cases distinguish between an affirmative duty on the aggrieved party to object versus an independent duty on the, in fact, you have, sometimes if a trial judge doesn't include a jury instruction, even if it's not requested by a party, if he had an independent duty to include that instruction in there, it's preserved. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Simmons?
May it please the court, counsel. I apologize for my voice. Starting off, I've been fighting this for about 2.5 weeks. I really think that on the main issue here is obviously is the verdict form, in my opinion. The verdict form in this case was not signed, and obviously we do have a statute that requires that it be signed, and it gives the situation or the result that a judge would follow in the case that it was not the statute was not followed, such as an unsigned verdict form. Somehow in this case, I'm a little confused as to how it occurred too. The judge was presented with this, and the record appears that it would show that he did look over the verdict form and then stated, we'll have the jury read this one. And I'm assuming that's because he could not determine that point what the verdict was. But what did happen after that is that the jury foreman did read the entire verdict from the verdict form out loud with a finding of guilt on behalf of the jury. And the defense then requested that the jury be polled, and they were, and each individual juror then stated on the record that they had made a finding of guilt in this case.
I'm assuming you would concede that Mr. Gladden's argument would be a lot stronger if the jury hadn't have been polled?
You know, on the Martinez case, which, again, it's unpublished, and it's out of San Antonio, the jury there was not polled. And they, in that same case, had an unsigned verdict form with no polling, and they found that they could still have enough evidence in that case to determine, reasonably ascertain, what the jury's verdict was, and found that it was a proper verdict, and then also found that if harmless were to apply, that it would be there would be a harmless error anyway because the record showed what the jury's verdict was. So our case is
Martinez your only case?
Ma'am?
Is Martinez the only case you were able to locate?
There's also Perez, which is a Houston case out of a
But that's not quite, Perez is not quite the same thing because it's not.
No. I mean, it applies the same analysis, and it just applies a different scenario underneath getting whether you call it an incomplete or an invalid verdict. Martinez is really the only thing I had. There's anything I could find on point anyway. But they do use the logic or the case precedent from the Court of Criminal Appeals regarding the liberally construction and the reasonable ascertained. And so all of these
let me beat you up a little bit.
No, go for it.
Mr. Gladden would say, Perez, none of those – doesn't matter. None of that stuff you just cited me matters. We don't even have a verdict here because the verdict per the statute has to be signed. So how do you respond to that argument? The argument that he made. Look, Your Honor's really not to get to those cases. Tell me your best argument.
I mean, my best argument is you're saying that there's not a verdict because it is not signed, which is required by statute. However, we have an oral rendition of the jury's verdict in this case. It merely was not written down, which is required by the statute. However, even if we're not following the statute and we've made this error, which obviously there is an error there, one, it wasn't objected to, and secondly, the record is clear and not ambiguous at all that these six jurors each individually found him guilty and then agreed unanimously to that. Stated such on the record.
But there's a procedure by which the judge has the, as Mr. Gladden put it, the affirmative duty when he receives a verdict that is improper to get it corrected. And how is a defense counsel supposed to know that that verdict form is not signed? How, I mean, I've been in hundreds of these trials. Nobody sees that verdict form before it becomes a part of the clerk's record. So how can they be held or deemed for not preserving when they didn't see it, but the judge did and had a duty to do something about it?
And I completely understand your argument. No other party, but the state as well, would not have seen it.
No.
Nobody but the judge and the jury and the bailiff saw the actual verdict form. But it doesn't negate from the fact that preservation is still required under law, whether or not it was brought to their attention. There's nothing that restricts them from reviewing each document had they wanted to. But because it's not a normal procedure and they didn't do it, doesn't negate the fact that we still have preservation rooted.
So your argument would be they need to file some sort of a post-trial motion to preserve it? I think Judge Gabriel saying, well, if you never see the verdict form, how can we hold it on Mr. Gladden's shoulders? Hey, you didn't object. Sorry, you're out of luck. I'm not saying
that it sounds fair. I can't make the laws not always fair. And I can't make it that.
But shouldn't we hold judges to what their duty is under the Code of Criminal Procedure, and that is to fix a verdict that's not in proper form?
Yes. I mean, we can't hold a judge to be perfect at all times. Of course, we would like them to know what their responsibilities are. There are several other areas in the law as well where judges may make mistakes, and the Court of Appeals or the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals will reverse and then change the opinion of the trial court based on an error. Or they may just reform the judgment. And there's different areas where we're able to say a mistake was made and we're going to fix it. But I think it's a windfall to say because they didn't look at the paper, and we normally don't, this entire case is over. These six jurors, no one can insinuate or figure out what they wanted to do. We can. And so we're just going to start over because there was a mistake here, and Richard Gladden is arguing about the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure in 1769.
It's a good law.
let me ask you two questions. You concede that this an unsigned verdict, if it's a verdict, is informal. So it falls under the terminology of 3710.
Yes.
Okay. Tell me why his arguments about harm or wrong.
Well, again, if you look at the case law, and I have just Martinez, which states that this is not a substantial right, is not affected by this anyway. So this is not a constitutional or jurisdictional issue or a substantial right. And under that analysis, 44.2 is going to apply. And how we're then going to say that there is any harm when the record clearly indicates that these six jurors, each and together, found the defendant guilty in this case. It's just there's no way there is any harm suffered by a defendant who was found guilty, other than the fact that the judge didn't make sure they signed a paper. It just throws away.
Well, I think Mr. Gladden would say the harm is we don't really have a verdict. We don't have a verdict that meets the statutory requirements.
It does.
Therefore, that's the harm. He's.
I think you'd have to word, I guess, that you didn't have that met the statutory requirements, and we often don't have judgments that don't follow the statutory requirements either. But this court and the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals often reform those judgments to reasonably ascertain and follow.
But we can't reform a verdict form.
No, Your Honor.
We just can't.
And I'm not indicating that you can reform it. In some situations, like under 37.10b, I believe that's there, you know, for the punishment section, that is something that can be done. And in this case, that what could have been done is send them back, which the court failed to do. But the state's argument is that this one error is harmless. This jury of six Denton County residents served their role, made a finding. And it's clear what their finding is. There is no ambiguity whatsoever. We have merely a signature that is absent. And although it is absent, we still have the record. So we have an oral verdict. Is that the required? It is not. Should this be allowed to happen on a regular basis? It's not. This is an isolated event. We would assume that none of us have ever seen.
We sign off on it and say it's okay. It can happen as many times as judges want that to happen because we said it's okay.
And if you say it's not okay, it could also happen again, and any defendant can just not look at it and refuse to object to it and walk into the courtroom and say, we have a void judgment. Everything starts over because I didn't object, and I'm not required to. So it could be a windfall in either direction, depending on how the court rules. But the windfall that the defendant is seeking in here is to give us this opportunity for us to sit back, not object, and then have no judgment whatsoever and get rid of everything, or find that this was a harmless error that occurred because we are sure what the result or verdict of the jury was, and we're not going to throw away the time that these six people put into determining this case. The state would just ask the court. I know that Martinez is an unpublished case and out of San Antonio, so it's a different district as well. But there has been no other case law finding that law that they're finding is incorrect. Many of their propositions are rooted firmly in law. So we're asking if the court would follow the Court of Appeals in San Antonio and find that error was not preserved in this case. And even if it were, this judgment was still reasonably ascertainable from the record, and that the jury made clear what their verdict was in this case, and that there was no harm would have resulted based on the lack of a signature when the record is so complete. Yeah. If no one has any further questions, I'll give my time back to the court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With regard to the preservation issue, as I understand it, and I think case law supports it, the reasoning or the rationale behind a preservation of error rule is it gives a trial court the opportunity to consciously be aware of an error and allows the trial court, once he has an opportunity to be consciously aware, to take action. In this case, a jury handed him what amounts to a blank sheet of paper with no indication of guilty or not guilty, no signature, it's not in writing, and he looks at it. He was confronted point blank, 20/20 vision, assuming that was his vision, to see that there is an error. And rather than correct the error, he gives it back to the foreman and has him verbally state what the verdict is. I think under those circumstances, any requirement for preservation of error or rationale behind it, that is alerting a trial court or given the opportunity, actual notice of an error, has been met. With regard to the error in this case, I think probably the state would agree with me that it's much better that we're here on a misdemeanor possession of marijuana case than a capital murder case where someone's been sentenced to be executed. We don't know the outcome of what your decision will be. We know what the statutory law says. And if the court does not make clear that the statute applies in this context, I suspect sooner or later you're going to have somebody convicted or a judgment of conviction for a much more serious offense where there was no verdict.
Let me ask you something. I haven't done the research that you've done, but I did find this Barton versus State came out in 1898. You didn't cite it, but it cites the Morton case. And it's dealing with whether the statute that was passed as a result of Morton that we're here today applied in misdemeanor cases. We had a verdict form that wasn't signed in the misdemeanor case, which right. This one is. And although the court in that case criticized the judge for not recognizing that the verdict wasn't signed, it says, look, the statute that was passed doesn't apply in misdemeanor cases.
Right. And what was the name of that case?
Barton versus State.
Right.
I didn't key cite this to see what's happened since then, but I'm assuming.
I'd like to address that. That I consider that case to be dicta, is that they say that we don't need to decide today whether it applies to misdemeanors. The letter brief I provided you.
Do you address it in there? Because I was curious.
Well, I don't cite that case, but what I do say is, first of all, in the briefs, I say that probably that case was dicta and it didn't purport to decide the question. If you look at the letter brief, Samuel Wilson, who was a commissioner, in his published digest, where he puts annotations and discusses each provision, he puts in there, he cites to the Morton case, which was a misdemeanor case, and says it was no, at one time it was not, prior to the passage of this statute, it was not required that verdicts be in writing or be signed, and cites Morton. But then it says, with the adoption of this, it is now required. And Morton was a misdemeanor case. And if the intent of the commissioners and the legislature to amend the code in 1879 to require it be in writing, and it's based upon abrogating legislatively the decision in Morton, which is clear it was, and Morton was a misdemeanor case, I think it's ineluctably certain that it was intended to apply to misdemeanors.
So to go along with you, we're going to have to write up a decision that says that this decision from 1898 was wrong, that was just dicta.
No. You say it didn't reach the question, because it didn't reach the question. I think in that case that you're referring to, and what was the name of it again?
Barton versus State.
No, not Morton versus State.
Barton.
Barton?
Barton.
Barton. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. In Barton versus State, I remember reading that, and I concluded that that was not. It was, number one, it was dicta. Number two, they expressly say we don't have to decide the question today whether it applies to misdemeanors. And so that's not binding authority. If they say they didn't have to decide it and they didn't decide it, it's not really precedent.
Well, you know, one man's dicta is another man's holding.
Well, if the holding was we're not deciding this question, I think that means we're not deciding that question. So I appreciate your time.
Let me ask you one question. This is not borne out by anything in the cases, but everybody says this verdict wasn't in writing.
Right.
Well, certainly there was writing here.
Well, and the jury,
and somebody and several people said that we are adopting this writing. The question is simply the absence of a signature. No matter what affirmation people give, that indeed they are adopting this writing just doesn't matter.
Well, okay. I don't think anybody said we're adopting this. He said, "Read your."
Let's say it is our verdict.
Okay. They can say verbally, it's our verdict. Our verdict is guilty, and that's our verdict, verbally. But because there is no writing, what you have there is the jury's form or the verdict form submitted by the court. The court did not conclude that that's not a verdict when the judge sent it to them before they deliberated. And so I don't think it becomes a verdict in writing if someone later says verbally, our verdict is guilty, and hands them a blank sheet of paper. It doesn't transform into a verdict without some writing on it. Otherwise, a jury verdict form without any indications of deliberations whatsoever could provide the predicate for a judgment of conviction. See what I'm saying?
Partially.
That's a pretty good argument. Thank you very much. Y'all have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. You both did a good job of explaining your respective positions to us. Your case is submitted, and you are excused. Our next oral argument's at 3, so we are going to take a recess until that time.